twice as tall as a man with steps on it. 12 scrambling people were climbing it fast as they could, making the wheel turn. They clung to a handrail over the top of it, their wrists lashed to it in case their grip slipped. The mill groaned and the corn cracked underneath. 2 black-skinned overseers paced with cowhides. Cat-o'-nine-tails, they called them. And when the wheel slowed, they hit the backs and legs of those poor people till you saw pink flesh ripple. Mr. Vesey's good eye studied me. Don't I know you from somewhere? From the church? No, somewhere else. I could have spit the truth out, but we were both in Daniel's lion's den, and God had left us to it. I said, where's all that delivering God's supposed to do? He snorted, you're right. The only deliverance is the one we get for ourselves. The Lord doesn't have any hands and feet but ours. That doesn't say much for the Lord. It doesn't say much for us either. A bell rang down below and the jaws on the wheel stopped chewing. The overseers loosed the people's wrists and they climbed down a ladder to the floor. Some of them were so used up they had to be dragged off. The overseer unlocked Mr. Vesey from the floor ring. Get on your feet. It's your turn.
Sarah. Handful's mangled foot was propped on a pillow, and Aunt Sister was laying a plantain leaf across the wound. From the smell that drifted in the air, I knew her injury had been freshly plastered with potash and vinegar. "Miss Sarah's here now," Aunt Sister said. Handful's head rolled side to side on the mattress, but her eyes stayed closed. She'd been heavily sedated with laudanum, the apothecary already coming gone. I blinked to keep tears away. It was the sight of her lying there, maimed. But some of my anguish came from guilt. I didn't know she'd been arrested, that Mother had decided to let her suffer the consequences in the workhouse. I hadn't even missed Handful's presence. This would never have happened if I hadn't returned Handful's ownership to Mother. I'd known Handful would be worse off with her, and I'd given her back anyway. That awful self-righteousness of mine. Sobby had brought Handful home in the carriage while I'd been away at Bible study. Bible study. I felt shame to think of myself, probing verses in the 13th chapter of Corinthians. Though I have all knowledge and all faith, and have not charity, I am nothing. I forced myself to look across the bed at Aunt Sister. How bad is it? She answered by peeling back the green leaf so I could see for myself. Handful's foot was twisted inward at an unnatural angle, and there was a gash running from her ankle to the small toe, exposing raw flesh. A row of bright blood beaded through the poultice. Aunt Sister dabbed it with a towel before smoothing the leaf back in position. How did this happen? I asked. They put her on a treadmill. Say she fell off and her foot went under the wheel. A sketch of the newly installed monstrosity had appeared in the Mercury recently with the caption, A More Resourceful Reprimand. The article speculated it would earn $500 profit for the city the first year. The apothecary say the foot ain't broken, Aunt Sister said. The cords that hold the bones are torn up, and she gonna be crippled now. I can tell from looking at it. Handful moaned, then muttered something that came out slurred and indistinguishable. I took her hand in mine, startled by how slight it felt, wondering how her foot hadn't crumbled to dust. She looked small lying there, but she was no longer childlike. Her hair was cut ragged an inch from her head. Little sags drooped beneath her eyes. Her forehead was pleated with frown lines. She'd aged into a tiny crone. Her lids fluttered but didn't open, as she attempted again to speak. I bent close to her lips.
Go away,
she hissed.
Go away.
Later I would tell myself her mind was addled with opiates. She couldn't have known what she was saying. Or perhaps she'd been referring to her own desire to go away. Anful didn't leave her room for 10 days. Aunt Sister and Phoebe carried her meals and tended her foot, and Goodis always seemed to linger by the back steps, waiting for news. But I stayed away, fearing her words had been for me after all. The ban on Father's study had never been lifted, and I rarely set foot there. But while Hanful convalesced, I slipped in and took 2 books, Pilgrim's Progress by Bunyan, and Shakespeare's The Tempest, a sea adventure I thought she would especially like, and left them at her door, knocking and hurrying away. On the morning Hanful emerged, we Grimkeys were having breakfast in the dining room. There were only 4 children who hadn't yet married or gone off to school. Charles, Henry, Nina, and of course myself, the red-headed maiden aunt of the family. Mother was seated at the head of the table with the hinged silk screen directly behind her, its hand-painted jasmine all but haloing her head. She turned to the window, and I saw her mouth part in surprise. There was Hanful. She was crossing the workyard toward the oak, using a wooden cane too tall for her. She maneuvered awkwardly, thrusting herself forward, dragging her right foot. "She's walking!" cried Nina. I pushed back my chair and left the table with Nina chasing after me.
"You're not excused," Mother called.
We didn't so much as turn our heads in her direction. Hanful stood beneath the budding tree on a patch of emerald moss. There were drag marks in the dirt from her foot, and I found myself stepping over them as if they were sacrosanct. As we approached, she began to wind fresh red thread around the trunk. I couldn't imagine what this odd practice meant. It had been going on, though, for years. Nina and I waited while she pulled a pair of shears from her pocket and cut away the faded old thread. Several pink strands clung to the bark, and as she plucked at them, her cane slipped and she grabbed the tree to catch herself. Nina picked up the cane and handed it to her. "Does it hurt?" Hanful looked past Nina at me.
"Not all that much now."
Nina squatted unselfconsciously to inspect the way Hanful's foot pigeoned inward, the odd hump that had formed across the top of it, how she'd fitted a shoe over it by trimming the opening and leaving off the lace. "I'm sorry for what happened," I said. "I'm so sorry."
"I read what I could of the books you brought. They gave me something to do beside lay there."
"Can I touch your foot?" Nina asked.
"Nina,"
I said. Then suddenly understood. Here was the nightmare she dreamed about since she was a child. Here was the hidden horror of the workhouse. Maybe Hanful understood, too, her need to confront it.
"I don't mind," she said.
Nina traced her finger along a crusting scar that flamed across Hanful's skin. Silence gelled around us, and I looked up at the leaves feathering on the branches like little ferns. I could feel Hanful looking at me.
"Is there anything you need?" I asked.
She laughed.
"Anything I need? Well, let's see now."
Her eyes were hard as glass, burning yellow. She'd borne a cruelty I couldn't imagine, and she'd come through it scathed, the scar much deeper than her disfigured foot. What I'd heard in her ruthless laugh was a kind of radicalizing. She seemed suddenly dangerous, the way her mother had been dangerous. But Hanful was more considering and methodical than her mother ever was, and warier, too, which made it more worrying. A wave of prescience washed over me, a hint of darkness coming, and then it was gone. I said to her, "I just meant..."
"I know what it is you meant," she said,
and her tone had mellowed. The anger in her face left, and I thought for a moment she might cry.
a sight I'd never witnessed, not even when her mother disappeared. Instead, she turned and made her way toward the kitchen house, her body listing heavily to the left. The determination in her pained me almost as much as her lameness, and it wasn't until Nina wrapped her arm around my waist and tugged that I realized I was listing with her. Some days later, Cindy knocked at my door with a note, ordering me to the first floor piazza, where Mother retreated most afternoons to catch the breezes. It was unusual for her to write out her summons, but Cindy had grown abnormally forgetful, wandering into rooms unable to recall why she was there, bringing Mother a hairbrush instead of a pillow, an array of queer errors that I knew would soon convince Mother to replace her with someone younger. As I made my way down the stairs, it occurred to me for the first time she might also replace Handful, whose resourcefulness and ability to walk to the market for fabric and supplies was now in question. I paused on the landing, the portrait of the Fates leering, as always, and my stomach gave a lurch of dread. Could this be the reason Mother had summoned me? Though it was early in May, the heat had moved in with its soaking humidity. Mother sat in the swing and tried to cool herself with her ivory fan. She didn't wait for me to sit.
"We've seen no progress in your father's condition for over a year. His tremors are growing worse by the day, and there's no more that can be done for him here."
"What are you telling me? Is he..."
"No, just listen. I've spoken with Dr. Geddings, and we're in agreement. The only course left is to take him to Philadelphia. There's a surgeon there of renown, Dr. Philip Fizik. I wrote to him recently, and he has agreed to see your father."
I lowered myself into a porch chair.
"He will go by ship," she said. "It will be an exacting trip for him, and it's likely he'll have to remain up north through the summer, or as long as it takes to find a cure. But the plan has brought him hope."
I nodded.
"Well, yes, of course. He should do everything possible." "I'm pleased you feel that way. You'll be the one to accompany him." I leapt to my feet. "Me? Surely you can't mean I'm to take Father to Philadelphia by myself. What about Thomas or John?" "Be reasonable, Sarah. They cannot leave their professions and families so easily."
"And I can?"
"Do I need to point out you have no profession or family to care for? You live under your father's roof. Your duty is to him."
Caring for Father week after week, possibly for months, all alone in a faraway place? I felt the life drain out of me.
"But I can't leave..."
I was going to say, "I can't leave Nina," but thought better of it.
"I will see to Nina, if that's what you're concerned about."
She smiled. Such a rare thing. The memory of being in the drawing room with the rector swept back to me. Mother's cold stare as I defended Nina's right to follow her conscience. I hadn't taken her warning seriously enough.
"As long as the two of you are under the same roof, there is little hope for Angelina." It hadn't been Nina whom Mother meant to remove. It had been I.
"You leave in 3 days," she said.
Handful. Mama pretended a limp, and I got the real one. I used her old wood cane, but it came up to my chest, more like a crutch than a cane. One day when the rain poured and Goodis couldn't work the garden, he said to me, "Give me that cane." "What for?" "Just give it here," he said. So I did. The rest of the day, he sat in the stable and whittled. When he came back, he had the cane clasped behind his back. He said, "I sure hope you like rabbits." Not only had the man trimmed off the bottom end to make it the right size, he'd carved a handle into a rabbit head. It had a round, speckled nose, big eyes, and 2 long ears going straight back. He'd even notched the wood to look like fur. I said, I like rabbits now. That was one of the kindliest things ever done for me. One time I asked him how he got his name, and he said his mama gave it to him when he was 10 because he was the goodest of her children. I could travel with the king like nobody's business. Cindy saw me coming to the kitchen house for supper that night and said I was springing across the yard like a rabbit. I had to laugh at that. The day after Cindy praised me, they took her off somewhere and we never saw her again. Aunt Sister said her mind had worn out, that Mrs. had sent her off with Thomas to their plantation, where she lived out her days. Thomas, he was the one taking care of the plantation now. And sure enough, he came back with a new maid for Mrs. named Minta. God help the girl. Cindy getting sent off like that put a scare in all of us. I went back to my sewing duties faster than you could say the word rabbit. I showed Mrs. how I could go up the stairs. I climbed sure and steady, and when I got to the top, she said, "Well done, Hetty. I'm sure you know how much it grieved me to send you to the workhouse." I nodded to let her know what a heavy burden that must have been for her. Then she said, "Sadly, these things become necessary at times, and you do seem to have profited. As for your foot, well, I regret the accident, but look at you, you're getting about fine." "Yes'm." I gave her a curtsy from the top step, thinking what Mr. Vesey said one time at church. "I have one mind for the master to see. I have another mind for what I know is me." I heard a tap-tap on my door one afternoon late, and Sarah stood there with her freckled face white as an eggshell. I'd been working on Master Grimke's pants. Mrs. had sent a slew of them down, said they were hanging off him too big. When Sarah came in, I was hobbling round the cutting table, spreading out a pair of breeches to see what I could do. I set the shears down. I only want to say, well, I have to go away. Up north, I don't know when I'll be able to return. She was talking with the pauses back in her voice, telling me about the doctor in Philadelphia, her having to nurse her daddy, being parted from Nina, all the miseries of packing that waited for her. I listened and thought to myself, white folks think you care about everything in the world that happens to them every time they stub their toe. "That's a millstone for you," I told her. "I'm sorry." And the minute it left my mouth, I knew it was coming from the true mind that was me, not the mind for the master to see. I was sorry for her. Sarah had jimmied herself into my heart, but at the same time, I hated the eggshell color of her face, the helpless way she looked at me all the time. She was kind to me, and she was part of everything that stole my life. "You take care of yourself while I'm gone," she said. Watching her walk to the door, I made up my mind. "Remember how you asked me a while ago if I needed anything? Well, I need something." She turned back and her face had brightened. "Of course, whatever I can do." "I need a signed note." "What kind of note?" "One that gives me permission to be on the street, in case somebody stops me out there." "Oh." That was all she said for a minute. Then, "Oh, Mother doesn't want you going out, not for a while. She's designated Phoebe to do the marketing. Besides, they closed the African church. There won't be anything to attend." I could have told you the church was doomed, but it was a blow to hear it. "I still need a pass, though." "Oh, why? Where do you need to go?" "It's dangerous, handful. I spent most of my life getting and doing for you and never have asked for a thing. I got places to go. They're my own business." She raised her voice at me the first time. "And how do you propose to get off the property?" Looking down on us was the little window Mama used to climb through. It was sitting high up, letting in the only light in the room. I said to myself, if Mama can do it, I can do it. I'll do it lame, blind, and backward if I have to. I didn't spell out my ways for her. I nodded at a piece of paper on the shelf beside a pen and a pot of ink. I said, If you can't see fit to write me this pass for safe passage, I'll have to write it myself and sign your name. She took a deep breath and stared at me for a moment. Then she went over and dipped a pen in the ink. First time I squeezed through the window and went over the wall, Sarah had been gone a week. The worst part was when I had to flop myself over the top of the bricks with nothing but the white oleander for cover. I had the rabbit cane and a thick burlap bundle tied on my back that made me cumbersome. And when I dropped to the ground, I landed on my bad foot. I sat there till the throb wore off. Then I slipped out from the trees to the street, just one more slave doing some white person's bidding. I chose this day because Mrs. had a headache. We lived for her headaches. When they came, she took to bed and left us to our blessed selves. I tried not to think how I'd get back inside the yard. Mama had waited for dark and crawled over the back gate, and that was the best remedy. But it was summertime, and dark came late, giving plenty of time for folks to wonder where I was. One block down East Bay, I spotted one of the guard. He looked straight at me and studied my limp. Walk steady, not too fast, not too slow. Squeezing the ears on the rabbit, I didn't breathe till I turned the corner. It took me twice as long to get to 20 Bull. I stood across the street and stared at the house, still in need of paint. I didn't know if Denmark Vesey had got out of the workhouse or what had happened to him. Last memory I had from that hellhole was his voice shouting, "Help the girl down there! Help the girl!" I hadn't let myself think about it, but standing there on the street, the memory came like a picture in a painting. I'm up on the treadmill, gripping the bar with all the strength I got, climbing the wheel, climbing the wheel. It never will stop. Mr. Vesey is quiet, not a grunt from him. But the rest are moaning and crying Jesus, and the rawhide splits the air. My hands sweat, sliding on the bar. The knot that lashes my wrist to it comes loose. I tell myself, don't look side to side, keep straight ahead, keep going. But the woman with the baby on her back is howling. The whip slashes her legs. Then the child screams. I look to the side, and its little head is bleeding. Red and wet. That's when the edges go black. I drop, my hands pulling free from the rope. I fall, and there ain't no wings sprouting off my shoulders. In the front window of his house, a woman was ironing. Her back was to me, but I could see the shape of her, the lightness of her skin, the bright headscarf, her arms swinging over the cloth, and it caused a hitch in my chest. When I got up on the porch, I heard her singing. Way down yonder in the middle of the field, see me working at the chariot wheel. Peering in the open window, I saw she had her hips swishing too. Now let me fly, now let me fly, now let me fly way up high. I knocked, and the tune broke off. She opened the door, still holding the iron, the smell of charcoal straggling behind her. Mama always said he had mulatto wives all over the city, but the main one lived here in the house. She stuck out her chin, frowning. And I wondered, did she think I was the new bride? Who you? I'm Handful. I came to see Denmark Vesey. She glared at me, then down at my twisted foot. Well, I'm Susan, his wife. What you want with him? I could feel the heat glowing off the iron. The woman had been hard done by, and I couldn't blame her not opening the door to stray women. All I want is to talk to him. Is he here or not? I'm here, a voice said. He stood propped in the doorway behind her with his arms folded on his chest like he's God watching the world go by. He told his wife to find something to do, and her eyes trimmed down to little slits. Take that iron with you, he said. It's smoking up the room. She left with it while he eyed me. He'd lost some fat from his face. I could see the top rim of his cheekbones. He said, you're lucky you didn't get rot in your foot and die. I made out. Looks like you did too. You didn't come to see about my health. He didn't want to beat the bushes. Fine with me. My foot hurt from trudging here. I took the bundle off my back and sat down in the chair. There wasn't a frill in the room, just cane chairs and a table with a Bible on it. I said, I used to come here with my mama. Her name was Charlotte. The sneer he always wore slid off his face. I knew you from somewhere. You have her eyes. That's what they tell me. You have her gumption, too. I squeezed the burlap bundle against my chest. I want to know what happened to her. That was a long time ago. Coming on 7 years. When he kept silent, I undid the burlap and spread Mama's story quilt across the table. The squares hung nearly to the floor, bright enough to set a fire in the dark room. People say he never smiled, but when he saw the slaves flying in the air past the sun, he smiled. He gazed at Granny Mama and the falling stars, at Mama leaving my daddy behind in the field, me and her laying in cut-up pieces on the quilt frame. He studied the spirit trees and the one-legged punishment. Didn't ask what anything meant. He knew it was her story. I stole a look at the last square where Mama had sewed the man with the carpenter apron and the numbers 1884. I watched carefully to see if he'd recognize himself. You think that's me, don't you? He said. I know that's you, but I don't know about those numbers. He chuckled outright. 1884. That was the number on my lottery ticket. The numbers that bought my freedom. The room was stifle hot. Sweat dribbled on my temples. So that's her last word, then. That's what it came to. A chance for getting free. A fancy chance. I folded up the quilt, wrapped it back in the burlap, and tied it on my back. I picked up my cane. I said, she was pregnant. You know that? When she went missing, your baby went missing with her. He didn't flinch, but I could tell he didn't know. I said, those numbers never did come up for her, did they?
Sarah. The ship ride was harrowing. We plied up the coast for nearly 2 weeks, sickened by heaving waves off Virginia, before finally making our way along the Delaware to Penn Landing. Arriving there, I had an impulse to bend down and kiss the solid ground. With Father almost too weak to speak, it was left to me to figure out how to retrieve our trunks and hire a coach. As we drew close to Society Hill, where the doctor resided, the city turned lovely, with its trees and steeples, its brick row houses and mansions. What struck me was how empty the streets were of slaves. The sudden realization caused a tightness inside of me to release, one I was not aware existed until that moment. I found us lodging in a Quaker boarding house near 4th Street, where Father relinquished himself to me. What he ate, what he wore, all decisions about his care. He even turned over the money pouches and ledgers. Every few days, I navigated us to the doctor's house by hired carriage. But after 3 weeks of seemingly futile visits, Father still couldn't walk more than a stone's throw without exhaustion and pain. He'd lost more weight. He looked absolutely desiccated. Seated in the doctor's parlor one morning, I stared at Dr. Physic's white hair and aquiline nose, a nose very like Father's. He said, "Sadly, I can find no cause for Judge Grimke's tremors or his deterioration." Father was not the only one who was frustrated. I, too, was weary of coming here optimistic and leaving dismayed.
Surely there must be something you can prescribe?
Yes, of course. I believe the sea air will do him good.
Sea air? He smiled.
You're skeptical, but it's quite recognized. It's known as thalassotherapy. I've known it to bring even the gravely ill back to health.
I could only imagine what Father would say to this. Sea air.
My prescription, he said, is that you take him to Long Branch for the summer. It's a small, rather isolated place on the New Jersey shore known for its sea cure. I'll send you with laudanum and paregoric. He should be outside as much as possible. Encourage him to wade in the ocean, if he's able. By fall, perhaps he'll be recovered enough to travel home.
Perhaps I would be home with Nina before September. The doctor had said Long Branch was small, but he'd exaggerated. It was not small. It was not even minuscule. It was barely existent. There were four farmhouses, one tiny clabbered Methodist church, and a dry goods store. Neither was the place rather isolated. It was woefully isolated. We traveled by private coach from Philadelphia for 6 days, the last one bumping over a foot trail. After stopping for toiletry supplies in the dry goods, we continued a ways further to Fish Tavern, the only hotel. It was perched atop a bluff overlooking the ocean, a large, sea-weathered edifice. When the clerk informed us that prayer meetings were held in the communal dining hall after dinner, I took it as a sign God had guided us. Father had come willingly. Too willingly, it seemed. I'd felt sure he would insist on returning to South Carolina. I'd expected him to quip,
"Do we not have sea air in Charleston?"
But when I'd broken the news to him there in Dr. Physic's examination room, careful to use the word thalassotherapy, he'd only looked at me for a long, strange moment. A shadow passed over his face, what I took to be disappointment. He said,
"Let's go to New Jersey, then. That's what we'll do."
That first afternoon before dusk, I brought cod soup to Father's room. When he tried to eat it, his hand quivered so violently, spoonfuls splattered onto the bedsheets. He lay back against the bedstead and let me feed him. I chattered about the squalling ocean, about the serpentine steps that led from the hotel down to the shore, almost frantic to divert us from what was happening. His mouth opening and closing like a baby bird's, ladling in the colorless broth, the helplessness of it. While I fed him, the crush of waves filled the room. Through the window, I could see a swatch of water the color of pewter, whipped by the wind into frothing swells. Finally, he put up his hand to let me know he'd had enough of soup and babbling both. I placed the chamber pot on the floor nearby. "Good night, Father." His eyes were already closed, but his hand fumbled for my forearm.
"It's all right, Sarah. We will let it be what it is."
17 July, 1819. Dear Nina, we are settled at Fish Tavern. Mother would call the place shabby, but it was once elegant and it has character. The rooms are nearly filled with boarders, but I've met only two. They are elderly widowed sisters from New York who come to prayer meetings each evening in the dining room. I like the younger one quite a lot. Father commands all of my attention. We came for the sea air, but he hasn't ventured from his room. I open the window, but the squawking gulls annoy him, and he orders the window closed by noon. I'm quite devious. I leave it open a crack and tell him it's shut. It's all the more reason I must go to the dining room and pray with the sisters. At 15, you are old enough that I may speak sister to sister. Father's pain grows worse. He sleeps long, fitful hours from the laudanum. And when I insist he take some exercise around the room, he leans heavily against me. I must feed him most of his meals. Still, Nina, I know there's hope.
If faith moves mountains, God will rally Father soon. Each day, I sit by his bed and pray and read the Bible aloud for hours at a time. Don't be angry at me for my piety. I am Presbyterian after all. As you know, we're fond of our gall and wormwood. I trust you're not provoking Mother too much. If possible, restrain yourself until my return. I pray Handful as well. Keep your eye out for her. If she needs protecting for any reason, do your best. I miss your company. Perhaps I'm a bit lonely, but I have God. You may tell Mother all is well. Your devoted sister, Sarah. Every day at specified times, the hotel clerk raised and lowered the red and white flags near the steps that led down to the beach. At 9 o'clock sharp, the red flag went up, signaling the gentlemen to take possession of the shore. I would observe them thundering into the waves, racing beyond the breakers, and diving. Surfacing, they stood waist deep, their hands on their hips, and surveyed the horizon. On the beach, they tussled or huddled together and smoked cigars. At 11, the white flag went up, and the men climbed the stairs back to the hotel with woolen towels draped about their necks. Then the ladies appeared. Even if I was in the midst of prayer, I would mutter a hasty amen and fly to the window to watch them descend the stairs in their bathing dresses and oilskin caps. I'd never seen ladies bathing. Back home, women didn't go into the ocean in fanciful get-ups. There was a floating bathhouse in the harbor off East Battery with a private area for females, but Mother thought it was unseemly. Once, to my astonishment, I spotted the two elderly sisters I'd written about to Nina, moving gingerly down the steps with the others. The younger one, Althea, always took pains to inquire not only about Father, but about me. "How are you, dear? You look pallid. Are you getting outdoors enough?" When I'd glimpsed her among the bathers that day, she'd glanced back, and seeing me at the window, she'd motioned me to join them. I'd shaken my head. But nothing would have pleased me more. The women always entered the water differently than the men, holding on to heavy ropes anchored to the shore. At times there would be a dozen of them stretched into the water, clinging to a single line, squealing and turning their backs against the spray. If Father was sleeping, I would stay at the window and watch with a lump in my chest until the white flag came down. On the morning of August 8th, I was there at the windowsill, neglecting my prayers, when Father woke, crying my name.
"Sarah!"
Reaching his side, I realized he was still asleep.
"Sarah!"
he shouted again, tossing his head in agitation. I placed my hand on his chest to steady him, and he woke with his breath coming hard and fast. He gazed at me with the feverish look of someone stumbling back from a nightmare. It saddened me to think I'd been part of it. During these weeks at Long Branch, Father had been kind to me.
"How are you faring, Sarah? Are you eating enough? You seem weary. Put down the Bible. Go for a walk."
His tenderness had shocked me. Yet he'd remained aloof, never speaking of deeper things. I pressed a cool cloth to his forehead. Father, I know coming here has been a trial for you, and your progress has been... It has been slow. He smiled without opening his eyes.
"It's time we spoke the truth. There has been no progress at all."
We mustn't give up hope.
"Mustn't we?"
The skin on his cheeks was as thin and sheer as a veil.
"I came here to die. You must know that."
"No, I certainly don't know that." I felt aghast, even angry. It was as if the bad dream had cracked his facade, and I suddenly wished for it back. "If you believe you're dying, then why didn't you insist we go home?"
It will be hard for you to understand this, but the last few years at home have been difficult. It seemed a relief to be far away, to be here with you and go quietly. I felt like here I could detach more easily from the things I've known and loved my whole life.
My hand went to my mouth. I felt my eyes film over with tears.
Sarah, my dear girl, let's not indulge in vain hopes. I don't expect to recover, nor do I want to.
His face blazed intensely now. I took his hand and gradually his expression eased, and he drifted to sleep. He woke at 3 in the afternoon. The white flag had just been raised. I could see it framed in the window, snapping against the translucent sky. I held the water glass to his lips and helped him to drink. He said,
"We've had our quarrels, haven't we?"
I knew what was coming and I wanted to spare him, to spare me. It doesn't matter now.
You've always had a strong, separate mind, perhaps even a radical mind, and I was harsh with you at times. You must forgive me.
I couldn't imagine what it cost him to say these words.
I do, I said, and you must forgive me. Forgive you for what, Sarah? For following your conscience? Do you think I don't abhor slavery as you do? Do you think I don't know it was greed that kept me from following my conscience as you have? The plantation, the house, our entire way of life depended on the slaves.
His face contorted, and he clutched at his side a moment before going on.
Or should I forgive you for wanting to give natural expression to your intellect? You were smarter than even Thomas or John. But you're female. Another cruelty I was helpless to change.
Father, please. I have no resentment of you. It wasn't completely true, but I said it. Giggles floated up from the beach below, tangled in the wind.
You should go outside and refresh your spirit, he said.
I protested, but he wouldn't relent.
How will you take care of me if you don't take care of yourself? Do this for me. I'll be fine.
I meant only to wade in the surf. I removed my shoes and placed them beside the portable changing house that had been wheeled out onto the sand. At that moment, the friendly sister, Althea, drew back the canvas and stepped out wearing a red and black striped bathing gown with a peplum flounce and balloon sleeves. I wished Handful could have seen it.
"How lovely! Are you finally bathing with us?" she said.
"Oh, no, I don't have the attire for it." She scrutinized my face, which must have radiated unhappiness in every direction, for she announced she'd suddenly lost the desire to bathe, and it would please her enormously if I would don her dress and take a plunge. After my conversation with Father, I felt flayed open, all pulp and redness. I wanted to disappear somewhere alone, yet I looked at the rope line of women jutting into the sea, and then beyond it at the green mountains of water, so limitless and untamed. And I accepted her offer. She smiled when I emerged from the changing room. She had no cap, and I'd unpinned my hair, which was flaming out in the wind. She said I looked like a mermaid. I took hold of one of the ropes and followed it into the waves, hand over fist, until I came to where the rest of the ladies stood. The water slapped our thighs, tossing us to and fro, a tiny game of snap the whip. And then, without knowing what I was about to do, I turned loose and strode away from them. I pushed into the seething water, and when I was some distance,
I dropped onto my back and floated. It was a shock to feel the water hold me. To lie in the sea, while upstairs my father lay dying. 9 August, 1819. Dear Mother, the Bible assures us that God shall wipe away every tear from our eyes. I lowered my pen. I didn't know how to tell her. It seemed strange I should be the one informing her of such news. I'd imagined her gathering us, her children, into the drawing room and saying, "Your father has gone to God." How was it possible this had fallen to me? Instead of the distinguished funeral he would have had in Charleston, the pomp of St. Philip's, a stately procession along Meeting Street, his coffin mounted on a flowered carriage and half the city walking behind it. Instead of all that, he would be buried anonymously in the overgrown cemetery behind the tiny Methodist church we'd passed on the way here. A farm wagon would pull his casket. I would walk behind it, alone. But I would tell Mother none of this. Nor would I tell her that at the hour of his death, I was floating free in the ocean, in a solitude I would remember all of my life, the gulls cawing over my head, and the white flag flying at the top of the pole.
Handful. Mrs. Eyes were swollen shut from crying. It was the middle of the morning, and she was in bed with her sleeping clothes on. The mosquito net was drawn round her, and the curtains were pulled on the windows. But I could see her lids puffed out. Minta, the new girl, was over in the corner trying to disappear. When Mrs. tried to speak to me, she broke down crying. I felt for her. I knew what it was to lose a person. What I didn't know was why she'd called me to her room. All I could do was stand there and wait for her to get a hold of herself. After a few minutes, she yelled at Minta, "Are you or are you not going to bring me a hanky?" Minta went scrambling through a drawer on the linen press, and Mrs. turned to me. "You should start on my dress immediately. I want black velvet with beading of some kind. Mrs. Russell had jet beads on hers. I will need a spoon bonnet with a long crepe veil down the back and black gloves, but make them fingerless mitts because of the heat. Are you remembering this?" "Yes'm." "It must be ready in 2 days, and it must be flawless. Hetty, do you understand? Flawless. Work through the night if you have to." Seemed like she'd gotten hold of herself real tight. She wrote me a pass for the market and sent me in the carriage with Tomfrey, who was going out to purchase the mourning cards. Said it would take too much time for me to hobble all that way and back. That's how I got the first carriage ride of my life. Along the way, Tomfrey said, "Wipe the grin off your face. We're supposed to be grieving." In the market, I was at the high-class stalls looking for the beads Mrs. had to have when I came upon Mr. Vesey's wife, Susan. I hadn't seen her since the first of the summer when I'd gone to 20 Bull. "Look what the field cat dragged up," she said. I guess she still had her dander up. I wondered what all she knew. Maybe she'd listen in that day I talked to Miss Vesey. She could know about Mama, the baby, everything. I didn't see any sense in keeping the feud going. "I don't have a bicker with you. I won't be bothering you anymore." That took the nettle from her. Her shoulders dipped and her face turned soft. That's when I noticed the scarf she was wearing. Red. Edges sewed with a perfect chain stitch, little oil spots on the side. I said, "That's my mama's headscarf." Her lips opened like the stopper had popped from the bottle. I waited, but she stood there with her mouth empty. "I know that scarf," I said. She set down her basket of cottons and took it off her head. "Go on, take it." I ran my finger along the stitched hem, crossed the creases where her hair had been. I undid the scarf on my head and tied Mama's on, low on my forehead the way she wore it. "How'd you get it?" I said. She shook her head. I guess you ought to know. The night your mama disappeared, she showed up at our door. Denmark said the guard would be looking for a woman with a red scarf, so I took hers and gave her one of mine, a plain brown one that wouldn't draw notice. You helped her? You helped her get away? She didn't give any kind of answer. She said, I do what Denmark says do. Then she sashayed off with her head stripped bare. I sewed through that day and night, and all the next day and night, and the whole time I wore Mama's scarf. The whole time I thought about her showing up at Mr. Vesey's that night, how he knew more than he was saying. Every time I took the dress upstairs for fittings, the house would be in a tizzy getting ready for the mourners. Mrs. said half the city was coming. Aunt Sister and Phoebe were baking funeral biscuits and seeing to their tea sets. Benna shrouded the paintings and mirrors with black swags, and Eli was put to cleaning. Minta had the worst job, in there getting hankies and taking the brunt. Tomfrey set up Master Grimke's portrait in the drawing room and fixed the table with tokens, had his beaver top hat and stick pins and the books of law he wrote. Thomas brought over a cloth banner that said, Gone, but not forgotten, and Tomfrey put that on the table too, with the clock stopped to the hour of his death. Mrs. didn't know the exact time. Sarah had written he passed in the late afternoon, so Mrs. said, just make it 4:30. When she wasn't crying, she was fuming that Sarah hadn't had the sense to cut off a lock of Master Grimke's hair and put it in the letter. It left her without anything to go in her gold mourning brooch. Another thing she didn't like was the notice that came out in the Mercury. It said he'd been laid to rest in the north without family or friends, and this would surely be a travail to a great son of South Carolina. I don't know how I got the dress done in time. It was the finest dress I ever made. I strung hundreds of black glass beads, then sewed the strands into a collar that looked like a spiderweb. I fitted it around the neck and let it drape to the bust. When Mrs. saw it, she said the one and only kind thing I can't forget. She said, Why, Hetty, your mother would be proud. I went through the window and over the wall on a Sunday after the callers had quit coming by to give their condolence. It was our day off, and the servants were lolling round, and Mrs. was shut away in her room. I had a short walk past the front of the house before I could feel safe, and coming around the side of it, I saw Tomfrey on the front steps, haggling with the slave boy who huckstered fish. They were bent over what looked like a 50-pound basket of flounders. I put my head down and kept going. Handful? Is that you? When I looked up, Tomfrey was staring at me from the top step. He was old now, with milk in his eyes, and it crossed my mind to say, No, I'm somebody else. But then, he could have seen the cane in my hand. You couldn't misjudge that. I said, Yeah, it's me. I'm going to the market. Who said you could go? I had Sarah's pass in my pocket, but seemed like he'd questioned that. She was still up north, waiting to sail home. I stood on the sidewalk, stuck to the spot. He said, What you doing out here? Answer me. Off in my head, I could hear the treadmill grind. A shape moved at the front window. Nina. Then the front door opened, and she said, What is it, Tomfrey? Handful out here. I'm trying to see what she's doing. Oh, she's doing an errand for me. That's all. Please say nothing to Mother. I don't want her bothered. Then she called down to me. Carry on. Tomfrey went back to the fish huckster. I couldn't get my legs to move fast enough. At George Street, I stopped and looked back. Nina was still out there, watching me go. She lifted her hand and gave me a wave. Close to 20 Bull, there was a little jug band going. Three boys blowing on big jaws and Gullah Jack, Mr. Vesey's man, slapping his drum. A crowd of colored folks was gathered, and two of the women started doing what we called stepping. I stopped to watch, because they were strutting Miss Lucy. Mostly, I kept my eye on Gullah Jack. He had fat side whiskers and was bouncing on his short legs. When he finished the tune, he tucked the drum under his arm and headed down the street to Mr. Vesey's, me following behind. I could see smoke from the kitchen house and went back there and knocked. Susan let me in, saying, "Well, I'm surprised it took you this long." She said I could give her some help. The men were in the front room meeting. Meeting about what? She shrugged. Don't know. Don't want to know. I helped her chop cabbages and carrots for their supper. And when she carried a bottle of Madeira to them, I trailed her. I waited outside the door while she poured their glasses, but I could see them at the table. Mr. Vesey, Gullah Jack, Peter Poyas, Monday Gale, plus two who belonged to the governor. Rolla Bennett and Ned Bennett. I knew every one of them from church. They were all slaves except Mr. Vesey. Later on, he'd start calling them his lieutenants. I slunk back into the hallway and let Susan go back to the kitchen house without me. Then I eased to the door, close as I could without getting seen. It sounded like Mr. Vesey was divvying up all the slaves in the state. I'll take the French Negroes on the Santee, and Jack, you take the slaves on the Sea Islands. The ones that'll be hard to enlist are the country slaves out on the plantations. Peter, you and Monday know them best. Rolla, I'm giving you the city slaves. And Ned, the ones on the neck. His voice dropped, and I crept a little closer. Keep a list of everybody you draft, and keep that list safe on pain of death. Tell everybody, be patient, the day is coming. I don't know where he came from, but Gullah Jack was on top of me before I could turn my head. He grabbed me from behind and threw me into the room. My rabbit came flying. I bounced off the wall and landed flat. He stuck his foot on my chest, pressing me to the floor. Who are you? Take your nasty foot off me. I spit at him, and the spew fell back on my face. He raised a hand like he was ready to strike, and from the edge of my eye, I saw Denmark Vesey pick him up by the collar and fling him half across the room. Then he pulled me up. You all right? My arms were trembling so bad I couldn't hold them still. Everything you heard in here, you keep to yourself, he told me. I nodded again, and he put his arm round me to stop the shaking. Turning to Gullah Jack and the rest of them, he said, This is the daughter of my wife and the sister of my child. She's family, and that means you don't lay a hand on her. He told the men to go back to his workshop. We waited while they scraped the chairs back and eased from the room. So he counted Mama one of his wives. I'm family. He pulled a chair for me. Here, sit down. What are you doing here? I came to find out the truth of what happened to Mama. I know you know. Some things are better not to know, he said. Well, that's not what the Bible preaches. It says if you know the truth, it'll set you free. He circled the table. All right, then. He closed the window so the truth would stay in the room and not float out for the world to hear. The day Charlotte got in trouble with the guard, she came here. I was in the workshop, and when I looked up, there she was. They'd chased her all the way to the rice mill pond where she hid inside a sack in the mill house. She had rice hulls all over her dress. I kept her here till dark. Then I took her to the neck, where the police in his light. I took her there to hide. The neck was just north of the city and had lots of tenement houses for free blacks and slaves who owners let them live out. Negro huts, they called them. I tried to picture one. Picture Mama in it. I knew a free black there who had a room, and he took her in. She said when the guards stopped searching for her, she'd go back to the Grimkeys and throw herself on their mercy. He'd been pacing, but now he sat down next to me and finished up the truth quick as he could. One night when she went out to the privy in Radcliffe Alley, and there was a white man there, a slave poacher named Robert Martin. He was waiting for her. A noise filled my head, a wailing sound so loud I couldn't hear. A poacher? What's a poacher? Somebody that steals slaves. They're worse than scum. We all knew this man. He had a wagon trade in these parts. First, regular goods. Then he started buying slaves. Then he started stealing slaves. He hunted for them.